You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2014 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Adam Burns on the subject, Learning to Lean. This class is titled, Values.
Well, good morning, everyone. So I'd like to commence this morning with an exchange, a swap meet. I have brought all the way from Australia a t-shirt that I intend to exchange. So you need to start thinking about what you're prepared to exchange with me for this t-shirt. It's a t-shirt from this place here, which is one of Michelle and I favourite spots to go. It's Manly Beach in Sydney, Australia. So this is the entrance to Sydney Harbour, and Sydney City sits back in here off this magnificent harbour, and on the north side is Manly Beach, one of our favourite spots. And I have this lovely t-shirt that I need to get rid of this morning. It's size XL. Now, we're influenced by our Asian sizing in Australia, so in America, which is influenced by McDonald's sizing, it's probably a small. So though it says XL, you need to think small. But I want an offer. This is a lovely t-shirt. It's Manly Beach, and I'm sure it'll look good on every one of you. It's just who it will be that has it. So who wants to exchange something for this? What have you got?
I have two shirts. You can have your choice.
All right. Something about Texas. What do we think about Texas, guys? Is it okay to wear Texas stuff, or is it... It's cool? Is it cool? Or, yeah, okay. Okay, I'm just going to park that. I'm going to see if I can get a better offer. Kyle, now I'm nervous. Kyle's got something. I don't want a dirty t-shirt. Okay, all right.
I'll exchange a half hour of food so I can employ
Casey Carroll. Okay. Texas is currently at the top, anyway, so... John?
Yeah, I have this really cool shirt from Manly Beach that you gave me a few years ago.
I'll take the new one without the stains. Yeah, I'll keep this one, I think.
I've got Angry Nerds.
Angry Nerds, okay, all right, okay. I've probably got plenty of those in Australia. There's lots of nerds there. Probably the Texas one's just getting there, yes, all right, so I think going once.
Completed homework.
That's right. $20, $50, $100, gone. So life is good. Oh. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Life's good. Texas is better. That's very true. Now you've got me. Oh, I don't know. Was it any of it caffeinated? Yeah. Okay. That's very cool. Give me the walking stick. Okay. I'm going to go with Texas. Sold. Thank you very much. So, with that exchange complete, what insight have you received into the both of us? What can you tell me about me as a result of that exchange? I don't like foot massages from men who I'm kind of don't really know. That's right. Well, that's true. That's one thing. I value caffeine. So you've discovered that. But at the end of the day, I went for the first thing. That's interesting. With what most of us do. Okay. And I also went with the kind of. Merciful, that's right. And also, I mean, I should let you know, I went with because it's an American thing. You know, I can take that home, it's a keepsake. So you can kind of get a bit of an appreciation of my values, what I value one above the other. Okay, the chocky thing nearly had me. I was pretty close to the chocolate thing, but at the end of the day, you have a little bit of an insight.
Didn't even get the nerds
of the lake. No, nerds. Nah, been there, done that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I guess that exchange is a simple little window just into what we both value. You value the Manly T-shirt over and above your Texas T-shirt. And I guess this kind of thing happens all day, every day, all over the world. Some communities, in fact, live by this method of transaction. It happens in remote areas of Asia, in African villages, and even online. Talking of online, in 2005, a man named Kyle McDonald started by trading this paperclip online. Now, this paperclip, it looks that big, but it's actually about this big, that paperclip. This very red paperclip. And he traded it 14 times over a little less than a year. And can anyone recall what he ended up getting to in his trades? A house, that's right. He traded 14 times, started with a paperclip and ended up with a house in Kipling, Saskatchewan. That's right. I was amazed for a while. Then I did, I'll Google Earth this. All right. Yeah. Yeah. I hear Canada's nice, but, you know. So it was a series of swaps and exchanges. And it's actually quite relevant to just think about this and think about exchanging, and all it kind of revealing is what you value for our first consideration this morning, which is the birthright. And we're going to try and get through the birthright and then the blessing this morning. All right, so let's just clarify, what is this thing called the birthright? Because it's kind of this, what's the birthright, what's the blessing, what's the distinction, and so on. The birthright's quite simple. It relates to order of birth, obviously, and it's about material possessions and, naturally speaking, who will be the head of the family. So naturally, who gets the stuff and who's the head of the family? And we see that this occurs with Abraham in relation to Isaac, who naturally wasn't the firstborn but was declared the firstborn when Abraham gave all that he had in Genesis 25 unto Isaac. But unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country. Another interesting reference to east and west. So Isaac, who assumed the role of the firstborn, receives the family inheritance and he receives preferential treatment to the other sons. Naturally, it's about the stuff and who is the head of the family. And I guess an obvious illustration of the difference is the difference between, say, Prince William and Prince Henry. We're tuned in enough to the world to know who that is. Is that right? Yes. Okay. Good. All right. What did I say?
Henry.
Whoops. Okay. That's the latest, isn't it? I think the latest boy's. Oh, that's George. No. Anyway. Okay. So it's William's birthright, just by the dumb luck of when he was born, it's his birthright to be the King of England, while Harry is just a prince. And so when we come to our story in Genesis chapter 25, and I might just ask you to turn to it, the story is plain and simple. I might just quickly read the five or six verses in Genesis 25 about this story of the birthright, and it commences at verse 29 to the end of the chapter. Once, when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And so we have here in this little incident one character who I guess is earthy, he's sensory, he's immediate, he's hungry, and another who is cunning, he's opportunistic, he's conniving, and I guess a little bit clever. So Esau, in exhaustion, wants the stew, and Jacob seeks an opportunity to take it. And I guess in such an exchange, oh, look at that, talking of exchange, I've got a choice. Or do I get two for the price of one? That's excellent. Thank you. One, okay, all right. Opportunity, conniving, yeah, not so clever, yeah. yeah, that's right. Okay, and so I guess in such an exchange we see the values, who values, where they place their value on the thing that they're giving away. And so we've got this insight, and much the same way we had an insight into us, we have an insight into these two boys' values. And so Esau says, I'm dying, the birthright's no use to me. And so by his actions, he places little value on the birthright. And it's accompanied by this nonsense kind of exaggerated statement, isn't it? This idea that that he was going to die if he didn't get something to eat. I mean, that's just a nonsense. Do you think that he might have, that he would have fallen on the ground in the middle of the family gathering, and for 3 days the family would walk around him? I think it takes about 3 days for someone to die of dehydration. And just sort of stepped over him. Excuse me, Esau, I know you're hungry, but excuse me. But, I mean, that's just a nonsense, isn't it? Or 4 to 6 weeks to die of starvation. That's typically what it takes. It'll take me about 6 months, but 4 to 6 weeks to die of starvation. I mean, it's just a nonsense to think that that would have, that he even thinks that that's possible. And we've got, so we've got this insight into Esau, and equally an insight into Jacob in this kind of, he's very clear thinking and very deliberate. He doesn't just make the deal, he seals the deal. He says, no, 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 I want you to swear it to me also. And I love that language at the end of verse 34. I think it's very deliberate. Esau ate and he drank and he got up and he went his way. Thus he despised his birthright. It's not until after he's finished all that, once strength has returned to his bones, once he's eaten and drunk, what's it going to be like once he's restored? Will he still despise it? Will there be any contrition? Will he sort of say, oh, I've got a full tummy now. I feel bad about this exchange. Can we kind of renegotiate, Jacob? It was none of that. He ate, he drank, he stood up, and he left, and thus he despised his birthright. It's almost like he had all these opportunities to still claw back the situation. And Hebrews 12 actually picks up on this, and it's a terrifying little section in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 15 to 17. Verse 15 commences, looking diligently over, lest anyone be failing of the grace of God. And this is why it's terrifying. We're talking here about two scenarios in which God's grace may be withheld from us. The grace of God may fail. Lest, first one, any root of bitterness springing up may give trouble, and through this many may be defiled. And secondly, lest anyone be a fornicator or a profane person as Esau, who in exchange for one morsel of food did sell his birthright. For you know that also afterwards, wishing to inherit the blessing, he was disapproved of for a place of reformation he found not, though with tears having sought it. And so two examples of how God's grace may be withheld from us. The first one references which is the root of bitterness quote there in verse 15, references the covenant of God with Israel in Deuteronomy 29, warning to Israel, to the Hebrews, that if you turn others away from God, if you make others go to idolatry, to worship false gods, then you put yourself outside of the grace of God. A somber thing to think about. So there's one way we might put ourselves outside the grace of God. And the second, of course, is you fail of the grace of God if you are like Esau and similarly turn your back on God. If the things of God are counted as worth less than a morsel of food, then the consequence is that you place yourself outside of the extent of God's grace. Turn others away, turn yourself away from God, then how can God do anything but say you are outside of his grace? And once again, it's all about values. We have what we value has a direct relationship with God's grace. And there's a nice little wordplay here with Esau being called a profane person. This little, I quite like this little Greek word here. It's babalos, and it's from it means the threshold. And as it says here, by implication of Jewish notions, heathenish or wicked. So there's this idea that he had crossed the threshold. He had we've got similar expressions such as crossed the line, went past the tipping point. We put a line in the sand and someone walks over it. There's the same little expression used by Paul that this person Esau had crossed the line. He'd gone across the threshold, and so he'd stepped past the point where God could extend his grace. And if that's our attitude, if we turn ourselves away from God, then of course, if our values aren't with God and his values, then yes, we naturally do cross the line and step outside of the grace of God. Now, in 2008, I had a brush with death. Do you like that? You get that? Yeah. Okay. It's not funny. I had a brush with death. It's not funny. Okay. During the middle of the GFC and with three very young children, for some crazy reason, I decided to leave my job, which was secure, and start a business. And I don't know why, but, no sick pay, no kind of anything to fall back on, no income stream. And so I went out and tried to work, do some business. And I remember doing a few lunches. And I was at one particular lunch with someone, and it was a Chinese meal. And during the afternoon, I started feeling pretty poorly, and I thought, bad rice. That's what you kind of, bad Chinese, bad MSG, whatever it was. Anyway, I started getting sicker and sicker. This was on a Friday afternoon. I started doing lots of shaking on Friday. And I thought, oh, it's just the rice. It's got to wear off over the next couple of days. All weekend, temperatures fluctuating and ending up in not just sort of fever, but rigors. Anyone know what rigors are? They're sort of just uncontrollable shaking. And so by Monday morning, I'd had enough of this, and so I drove myself to the hospital, and no one knew what was wrong with me. It was too long a period for it to be the rice, and the doctors loved it because they had no idea what was going on. And you doctors are crazy, Wendy. You're just like, this is like, it's awesome. So, you know, the infectious diseases doctors came in, and they just thought this was awesome. Got a patient, don't know what's going on. And then they discovered that I'd been to Africa not long before that, and so, you know, the international overseas, I don't know what they called, foreign diseases doctor came in and with a big smile on his face trying to work out, this is great, what's going on with this guy? And in the end, I had eight nights in hospital. That's a long time, I think. I mean, you have a cesarean, not that I've had a cesarean, but you have a cesarean, that's 5 nights in Australia you have in hospital. So we had 8 nights, and anyway, at the end, it was all okay. I'm still here. And I guess times like that, those eight nights where you're really sick, kind of bring perspective, don't they? They give you kind of clarity of vision. You start to appreciate out of all the stuff in your life what it is that matters. And it's a relatively narrow amount of things that actually really matter in your life. There, of course, is God, the Lord Jesus Christ, and our hope. I mean, it's right up there. And anyone here who's been sick will know this much better than me. There's your wife and your kids. There's your sort of your immediate family. Not really extended even. Sort of your mum and dad and your sisters and your brothers. Just those few people you sort of worry about. And only a real handful of friends. Just, I don't know, for me at least. Maybe I don't have many friends. But for me at least, it's just a very small, intimate group of people. That's all that's really on your mind. And I don't know if any of you have had a serious medical condition, you'll know this. And I guess what I'm coming round to is there is just such power and comfort in our hope, isn't there? I mean, who's been sick here? Who knows that? I mean, you just know that when you are unwell, there is just such power and comfort in our hope. Because I didn't know what was going on, I kind of feel maybe I stared death in the face. I don't know. But I was sick. I was scared, all that sort of thing. But you kind of see starkly at those moments just how valuable your birthright is. When we're at our lowest, when our life is threatened, when we're anxious, when you're not kind of in control of anything that's happening around you, your birthright, and that's by analogy, you know, our hope in Christ, God and Christ, is just elevated in value beyond anything. And I guess just that just helped me understand just how much Esau despised this thing. You know, if he was truly close to death like he thought, then this is just a demonstration of how profane this man was. We should see a man desperate to hold on to his birthright, but it's the opposite. Profanely, he just gives it away. All right, so that's Esau. We've been a little bit honest about Esau, but is anyone uncomfortable about Jacob in this situation? Does anyone think, yeah, Jacob, good one, good deal? Is anyone, no, yes, like I'm certainly uncomfortable. I mean, there's a story of opportunism and exploitation, thank you, of another's weakness. So I think there is something good to say about him, but there's also a problem. The first, the good is, I guess, if the exchange reveals Esau's values, then equally, of course, it reveals Jacob's values. He aspired to be the head of this particular family. So for me, it's not a difficult leap to conclude that Jacob aspires to more than just, hey, I want the stuff. I want to get the lion's share of the wealth. And thinking about Moses' commentary that this is a man who lives in a tent, I see a man who aspires to be part of the Abrahamic covenant. And so I guess just my thinking in that, I guess the point that makes me arrive at saying, okay, I can see good values in Jacob here is, first of all, Moses' comment about him living in a tent. I think that's, as we said yesterday, code for character. Jacob clearly values the birthright, at least above food. So I think he sees there's something spiritually important. Esau, of course, is profane for not valuing it, so it can't be just about the cash. There must be more. If he doesn't value it and that's profane, then it must be more to this birthright. And I think the other thing that's important to note here is that this was just a swap. In the same way that we've swapped a T-shirt, that we're both quite comfortable with that, well, here we'd have to be too uncomfortable in terms of Jacob and Esau. Both of them were quite comfortable to undertake that exchange. But there is, of course, a flaw with Jacob. What have I said here? So he's valued the birthright, he struck a fair transaction, and I say his modus operandi is fair. They struck a fair deal and they did it. But there is a flaw, I think, when it comes to Jacob, and there's a good reason to feel uncomfortable here. He kind of lacks something. And I think we see this when we compare him with another man in the Old Testament who had a very similar dilemma in his life, David and Jacob. Let's just have a look at the similarities here. David was, of course, promised the throne. Jacob, of course, is promised the birthright. David valued the throne. Jacob valued the birthright. In front of Jacob that stood before him was Saul, who was self-absorbed. Similarly, Esau was self-absorbed. Saul stood in the way, Esau stood in the way. But David, of course, patiently waits for God, whereas Jacob does not. And I think as we read that account in Samuel, we are all of us, I'm sure, so impressed with the way David deals with his situation. Saul goes that way, David runs this way. Saul's army runs this side of the mountain. David runs away the other side of the mountain. Saul stands in front of him in the cave, apparently delivered into his hand, and David just cuts off the robe. He patiently stands back and leaves it to God. And there's an interesting comment, of course, in 1 Samuel 24, when David says to Saul in the cave, "May the Lord judge between me and you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. So David's hands were not, but of course in this exchange we once again see Jacob's hands at work. Well, it's pretty early on in his life, isn't it? We've only seen it coming out of the womb, but here we are busy lifting his hand to try and achieve an outcome for himself. So Jacob fails to wait patiently for God, unlike David. Is there anyone like to make any comments there on the birthright before we move to the blessing? No questions, just comments. He didn't, sorry, the last one. Yeah. So I think he didn't make Esau buy it. So just explain that last bit, yeah. Sure, yeah. So yeah. Yep, and so we are seeing Esau doesn't place value on the birthright, is one comment, and the other is I agree that Jacob acts poorly here and takes advantage of Esau. Any other comments? That's true, yeah, so yeah, he must have had an appreciation that this boy had no interest in being ahead of this family, this particular family, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Eric, and then we'll...
I just wonder how much his mother
had to do with it. Yeah, and we'll think about the mother very shortly.
I think the long-term enmity situation just bubbles.
Yep. It's entirely wrong. We're talking about a family here. You think about the Lord. You ask a man for his coat, and you should also give him... You know, this just doesn't happen in the family, does it? It's not the way it is. All right, okay, last one. Let's go. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. Isaac seems to try and get around this in our next incident. Yeah. Spiritual transaction. Yeah, I agree. Because there's more to this than just the stuff, yeah? It's got to be more. This is a special family with special roles and special responsibilities. Wendy, come on up. Wendy, we don't have time to read Genesis chapter 27, so I'm going to ask Wendy. There's good. Just to quickly remind us about the next incident, which is the blessing. Tell us about the blessing. That's good. That's good. Everyone? Okay, go. No, it's yours. You take it. Beginning of chapter 28. Okay, everyone give it up for Wendy. That's it. Yeah. Thanks, Wendy. So if the birthright is acknowledging who will receive the goods and be the spiritual head, the blessing is the ceremony. It's the kind of the coronation, the time at which it moves from the conceptual to the actual. So Prince Charles has the birthright, of course, and he's awaiting his coronation, or his blessing still awaits him. Okay, now, this event is entirely perplexing. It's littered with bad behaviour from beginning to end. Every single person in this incident behaves poorly: Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob and Esau. And we don't have time to dwell on every aspect of the story, just to, I guess, extract some points of interest. And the first is with Jacob. We see how it is when there's with Isaac. When we see how it is when there is a favoured child. Isaac, he prematurely, as Wendy said, thinks that he's close to an end, and he says, "I'm going to bless Esau." And I think we've just got to be careful here and Wendy said it was a very generic blessing. We've got to be careful not to assume that Isaac's trying to give away the Abrahamic covenant. It's not his to give away. I think it's a mistake to think that he was trying to give that away. The Abrahamic covenant was given by God to Abraham, God to Isaac, and it'll be the same when it comes to God and Jacob. And I think that's quite apparent in verse 33 when it says that Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you, came." So he's talking to Esau, "and I have blessed him." Who was this person that I've actually blessed? And then it seems almost at that very moment is his moment of faith when he says, "Yes, and he shall be blessed." Because as you know, in Hebrews chapter 11, this is Isaac's moment of faith that's identified in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, it says, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. And I think this must be the moment that's referenced in Hebrews 11. There's no other time when Isaac blesses both Jacob and Esau. Many people turn to Genesis 28 to say, well, this is the time of faith. But I think it's that very moment towards the end, in verse 33, I think it is, where he says, and yes, he shall be blessed. It's got to be the moment of realization and the moment of faith. I think there's a little important development in Hebrews chapter 11 about faith that's being presented here. When it came to Abraham, he was obedient and he fully responded to God. So that's Abraham's moment of faith mentioned in Hebrews 11. When it comes to Isaac, yes, he too was obedient. Yes, he too fully responded to God. But the difference between Abraham and Isaac, he did it against his own will. I think you've got this little development of what faith looks like, faith in through different lenses. Yes, Abraham obeyed and he responded. Isaac obeyed and responded even when it went against his own preferred outcome. Rebecca, she also appears very poorly. She again plays favourites like Isaac. She's got this unbalanced preference for her children. She orchestrates and facilitates the deception of her own husband. She certainly knew of God's prophecy, that's true, but she, like Jacob, is impatient for its fulfillment. She tries to rush it, much like Jacob does. And what about our man Jacob? Well, it's a pretty disappointing insight into him. He doesn't appear positive in any way whatsoever. He's coerced by his mum. His only challenge to his mum is, well, what if I get caught? It's kind of a wimpy kind of response, and I'm cursed instead of blessed. He lies to his dad. Probably worst of all, he uses God's name in his deceit. Like his dad says, how'd you get that stew together so quick? Oh, God helped me. I mean, he just used God's name in the deceit. And he dresses up and he play-acts in this scene that's almost like taken out of a page of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and inserted in Genesis. It's just kind of this crazy pantomime of acting and dressing up. And his expressed only concern is for himself throughout all the exchanges. And so it's not a good incident. There's little to recommend Jacob to us in it. And I guess, once again, it's impossible to miss the signature mark of Jacob in this story. I mean, his hands are there kind of dressed up in this crazy hairy goat skin, and once again, they're there right in front of us. Ludicrous though they are, we can't miss his hands in this story. And I guess the main thing that we've got to try and take from this is this incident is just to learn from its folly and to see not just the folly of the day, but the folly of the tragic consequences that emerge out of this day. I mean, Rebecca, her words will come back and haunt her. You might remember she is willing to take on. Jacob says, what if I get a curse instead of a blessing? She takes on the curse. She says, I'll take that curse. Don't worry about that, boy. And in what must have just been a few days later, maybe the same day, Jacob walks away from her and he never sees her again and she never sees her boy again. I mean, the tragic consequences of this day just echo on. Jacob too, his actions will come back to haunt him and echo throughout his life. He chooses deception, and again, there's this echoing of deception that keeps continuing in his life. Deceived in his marriage, deceived in his wages, deceived by Laban's two-faced dealings. His sons deceive him in the matter of Joseph. The entire town around of Shechem's deceived in the matter of Dinah. And you just see this echo of deception, these tragic consequences going on and on. And Isaac too. He loses touch with the seed of the promise for 40 years. He doesn't see his boy for 40 years. And so the division that tore through this family at the end of this day is just, it's catastrophic. It's a sad day for the family of promise. So what do we learn from Jacob about this? What do we take from it? I mean, did he think that his deception of Isaac could be binding? I mean, it mustn't have been. Surely that's what verse 33 is saying. When Isaac says, "I bless the wrong guy, and yes, he shall be blessed," Isaac would have had the opportunity to reverse that. That must be what that moment of faith is talking about. There was an opportunity for Isaac to reverse the blessing. So I don't know. I can't understand Jacob's thinking here. I don't know how he thought that this would be binding upon Isaac. And yet, we must be aware, and I guess cognizant of the fact that Jacob valued this thing. This is so crazy. What happened that day, I guess we can only see in any good in it, is that he did at least value this thing. Bad behaviour, no doubt, but his values are clear. And so for us, there's a really solemn, somber lesson in this. And it's this. It's possible for every single one of us here to have correct values and spiritually focused motives and still act in a way that is destructive, deceptive, corrupt, and out of step with God. And this is, again, a scary kind of thing. We've all got a role. We all do things in our family, in the ecclesia. But it's something we've just got to be aware of, whether you're an arranging brother, whether you're on the CBMA, whether you're part of the committee here, whether you're a Sunday school teacher, whether you're a marriage counsellor, a marrying brother, or whatever you might be, you've got to take heed to this potential danger. Because if attitudes or actions that involve self-promotion or deception or misleading conduct or not full disclosure of the facts or whatever it might be, if even if it's spiritually motivated, even if you can see a good outcome, then it's not justified. I can't think of any situation where, in our ecclesia, where poor action can be justified even if you're seeking a better outcome. The heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. We can't know it. We need to be very careful to learn from today. And so this chapter, I guess, closes with one of the most ironic moments in Scripture. Jacob's got the birthright, so he's got the promise of the head of the family ship. He's got the blessing that activates the head of the family, and yet head of family, got the birthright, got the blessing, and yet we find him separated, alone from that family. We find him walking away, eastward, away from that family. Behind him is Abraham and Isaac and the land of promise and the family of promise, and this man is walking away from all of that. I'm going to finish in a moment. I guess this session's been heavy on negative stuff, and I want to finish with something remarkable, something positive. And I want us to try and just slip into Jacob's shoes now and try and just get involved with where he is at emotionally. Try to understand him. The sun setting behind him. Family of God's behind him. Back in the west, he's walking away from them. I guess the closest I can think of that is those kind of parables of sheep and goat. I don't certainly like to think about it, but that kind of those parables of if you're declared a goat, and I'm not quite sure how this all works, and we have various ideas within our community, but if you are separated away from all that, all those people, those sheep that are going into the kingdom, all those people that are with the Lord Jesus Christ, imagine that moment. And I think then we kind of can sort of feel where Jacob's at this moment. So he's lonely, he's alienated, and he's hopeless. And as the sun sets, he picks up a stone and he brushes the dirt off and he lays it under his head, a thoroughly dejected man. No tent, just a stone in a rocky field alone. Now it's at this very dark moment that we enjoy a window into our Father's character. Now just think about the mercy of God, the majesty of God, that Jacob's just used his name in vain, he's just tried to rush his purpose, he's just chosen not to be patient with him, he deserves to be lonely, alienated and hopeless, and yet God does the exact opposite. God visits Jacob. He's granted an audience with God. I mean, the Lord God, he is entirely remarkable. His character just shines through in this incident. It's brilliant. Jacob's in abject dejection, and he meets God in a vision of the angels up and down the ladder. God's timing is perfect. And so as we finish, I would like you just to take a moment to maybe reminisce or ponder on those times when God has actually done this very same thing for you. When he, at just the right time, has acted in your life. It'd be nice if we had time to share these things, but we obviously don't. When God has answered your prayer at just the right time and in his way. When God has intervened in your life at just the right time and in his way. When God has made something happen that would change things for you at just the right time and in his way. In God's way and at just the right time, Jacob's life is just flipped on its head. In God's way and at just the right time, maybe the same has happened for you. Your very own Bethel moment. And if you're awkward about that, because some people are, then I want to sort of try and declare, well, that was definitely God acting at that moment. If you are awkward about that, if you find it difficult to get to that point where you say, okay, that was definitely God acting for me at just the right time and in his way, if you find that difficult, well, then you can be certain of at least this, that Christ arrives right on time to die for the ungodly. He didn't and doesn't wait for us to get ready. He presented himself for this sacrificial death when we were far too weak and rebellious to do anything to get ourselves ready. And even if we hadn't been so weak, we wouldn't have known what to do anyway. Right on time, God acts, Christ arrives, and your life is changed, and you will never be the same again. Thanks be to God.